Blog Talk Radio.
Spend some time in the country, we're glad that you dropped by. Spend some time in the country, leave your worries behind. There's lots of fun for everyone, the best in music too. Spend some time in the country, we've been waiting here for you. Here in the country, waiting here for you.
You found the place for up close and personal interviews with your favorite country stars. This is In the Country, hosted by Dave Wood. Stay tuned for great stories and great music. Now live from Ontario and heard around the world, welcome to the show.
Canadian hitmaker Larry Wayne Clark is my guest on the show today. He's here to talk about his musical journey, from songwriting to demos to radio hits, and all the steps he took along the way. I've got three songs to play that feature Larry's songwriting: an early 90s hit for Lee Greenwood, a more recent hit for Chris Young, and what's sure to be a future hit for a great Canadian country artist. Stay tuned for lots of great stories and great songs. My pleasure to welcome on the line from New Brunswick, it's Larry Wayne Clark. Hey, Larry.
How you doing, Dave?
I am doing wonderful. How are you this evening out there in New Brunswick?
Not too bad. The rain stopped temporarily, and the snow has been melted, and it was actually quite a pleasant day here. Could almost forget it was winter.
Nice to hear. Those are good days. A little different story in Ontario with tons of snow, but we all get our turns with it for sure.
Yeah, I've been hearing some horror stories about what's going on in Ontario, but what can you do?
Pretty
We're
bad.
Canadians. It's winter.
That's exactly part of what we get for all the good times. We get a lot of snow. We got a lot to cover here, as I mentioned in the introduction. And the great thing is we've got three songs to share. One of them most people wouldn't have heard because it's going to be a song released in January. So we got a great sneak preview on that one. But let's go back, Larry, to when you first got fascinated by songs. And I've read at LarryWayneClark.com just how much as a youngster you really were fascinated by songs and songwriting.
Well, that's true. I have no real explanation for why songs moved me as deeply as they did, but it's just something that has always been with me. I mean, I was I was the type of kid that really got into watching a movie or a television show or reading a story. You know, I got very involved in anything like that, and I still am that way. I still like all those things, but songs, of course, are a thing apart. They're a little bit of everything. They're music, and they're stories, and they're poems, and everything kind of wrapped up into one. There's just a magical fusion that happens when you blend the words and music together and make something larger than the sum of the parts, I guess. And I was just always really moved by songs, even as a kid. It didn't matter what they were. I mean, it'd be songs I would hear in a cartoon, or it could be, a song like "Waltzing Matilda" or something. And just I had a strange appetite for songs, and I didn't come from a particularly musical family. I didn't. It was many years before I learned how to play anything, but I just always had this. This strange affinity with songs.
Now, can you take us back to when you first decided you were a fan at that point of songs and enjoyed songs, when you actually started to create your own and write your own songs? And then how did that go at first?
Well, I've had a strange journey into this because compared to just about anybody that I know, whether they be a songwriter or an artist or a player, just about everybody began their career in their teens and 20s. And I almost look at myself as having missed a decade. I did learn how to play some guitar in my teens, and for a time there I had a friend that I sang with. We used to sort of harmonize together on things and enjoy doing that. And that was when I made my first embryonic stabs at writing songs during that time when I was, 17, 18, 19 years old. But I didn't know, basically, I just didn't have a direction for it all. I discovered that I didn't like performing. I'm not a person who needs to be up on a stage. I don't live for applause. That just doesn't seem to be the thing that that turns me on. And I know people who are turned on by that. I mean,
right.
I'm thinking, as I say this, of the young Lisa Brokoff when I first met her in her teens, and she was a very quiet, subdued sort of a kid. But when she got on stage, it was like somebody turned the switch. You know, there was a definite alteration in her entire being, a transformation. And this is a person who truly loves to perform, and I've met many like that. But I never had the desire to learn a couple of hundred cover tunes and go on the road with a band or whatever. It just didn't happen. So my interest in music, it never died by any means, but I had no intentions for it, and during my 20s, I just did other things. I was a nomadic sort of a person, and I tried various kinds of work, and somehow that decade went by, and it wasn't until I moved to Vancouver, which happened in it happened in 1980, actually, right at the start of the decade. I was actually working a sales job at that time, and I got transferred there, and shortly thereafter quit the sales job, which I hated. But here I was in Vancouver, which I liked a lot. You know, I liked liked being there, and I had a kind of I don't want to get strange about it, but just a kind of a rebirth there as a musically speaking. I got really excited again about wanting to do something musical, and now I was I was older, and I wanted to try and find something to do with it, and I took a seminar basically at UBC, a weekend seminar put on by an LA-based lyricist named Buddy Kay, and that was an eye opener for me. This was just, I guess, at the beginning of people putting together these various mentoring and teaching programs for songwriters. That was kind of unheard of prior to that time. And this guy just made a really good case for the fact that you can be a songwriter, you can be a grown-up human being who writes songs for a living. That's perfectly legitimate, and if you do it well and do it diligently and get a bit of luck, it could even be profitable. And he just sort of advocated the whole life, and he did it well. He looked like a guy who enjoyed his life. He was a middle-aged guy and had some success. And I never looked back from that. And then the other thing, the other point that he made, and this is very pertinent to what we're doing right here, he said that country is the place to be for a freelance songwriter in this day and age. Country music is he said Nashville is the new Tin Pan Alley of our times.
Right.
For a songwriter. And a very good point. I totally agreed and still do. And he said, you need to be paying attention to what's going on in country, and in particularly in country crossover, which at that time represented people like Crystal Gayle and especially Kenny Rogers and a couple of others. And it made a very good point, and he played some songs, he played some demos, and basically I really got hooked by all that, and I did start making a very concentrated effort to learn more about country music, which I liked in a casual way. I'd always liked Marty Robbins and Johnny Cash, and I liked Kenny Rogers, and I'd always been very open to country, but it had never been my specific genre. I didn't have one, and I began buying albums, vinyl albums, and listening to them, putting headphones on, really scrutinizing how songs were being assembled and being produced, and of course paying attention to the songs themselves and the chords being used and the subject matter, and just trying to understand what made a song a hit, and how people wrote those hits. And
what were some of those ingredients that you learned early on as you were listening to those albums and then starting to get into your own songs and trying to write commercial stuff? What are those ingredients that go into what we call a hit song?
Well, the more you learn, that you're never going to know it all. You're never going to, for instance, you're never going to be able to predict why a song like Whiskey Lullaby became such a big hit when that basically breaks every rule that you're told. I mean, it was a song about a double suicide. It was a ballad. It was in a minor key. There was everything wrong with that in terms of commercial radio. And yet, I talked to Bill Anderson one time, and he said, you know, radio made that song. It was the radio people who started saying, were listening to the CD and started saying that this should be a single. So, you know, it can be very unpredictable, but obviously you have to touch people in some way. Generally, you do that by engaging some emotion, whether it's humor or pathos. You know, you make them cry, you make them laugh, you perhaps make them feel, make a listener feel part of a larger system, you know, by a song that they feel represents their lives, and that, you know, hundreds of thousands of other people are also listening to, and they feel that represents their lives. Songs about family matters and so forth. You know, you try to pick some identifiable theme and material. I'm a great believer in melody. I love great melodies. I think they're truly magical. And so, you know, anytime you could come up with a talking in your sleep kind of melody written by Roger Cook and Bobby Wood.
Yeah, great Crystal Gale classic.
Yeah, great song. Yeah. Just a gorgeous song from the first chord, and songs like "Can't Make You Love Me," that just capture you with a kind of a sensual magic, a musical magic. That's great if you can if you can attach a terrific tune to a song. Obviously, in country, the lyric is extremely important. It's much scrutinized, and it is very important. People want to be able to understand the words, understand them being uttered, first of all, in the recording, and understand what they mean, and relate to them in some way, react to them in some way. So you really need to pay attention to wordsmithing as a songwriter. And, of course, you can't get better advice on that than to just listen to other great songs, and of course to read. You can't be a writer without being a reader. You know, I'm a great advocate.
Yeah, you really have to read and get your vocabulary to a certain degree, not necessarily a high degree, but just to know a lot of different words, because words have certain sounds that can make a song.
Yeah, and just observe how other writers put their point across, whether they're telling a story or writing a song or whatever. I mean, there is a way that you can tell things very compactly. I always, in a conversation like this, I always go for the example of Old Red. That was a big hit for Blake Shelton a few years back.
Yeah.
And was already an established song. I mean, you look at the first line or two of that, and you get, you know, I found my woman with another man, and it cost me 99. That guy is telling you so much in those few words.
Yep. Yeah.
You think about that, that's almost like a short story unto itself. He obviously came across a tryst between his woman and some guy. He obviously did some, he obviously created some mayhem and got arrested and went to court. and sat before a trial and was sentenced to 99 years. And you
and
learn
right away
all
you
of that.
Listen, yeah, as soon as you hear that line, you want to know what's going to happen.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that is a great it's a great story song. I mean, that's just in the last couple of years, last 5-6 years, and it's just a classic story song. What happens throughout that one, and right to the very end, you're wondering, and of course, the end is quite a twist or quite
oh,
an
yeah,
ending.
Oh
yeah,
that beautiful little O. Henry flourish at the end. I mean, it's a classically written song, and frankly, I want to hear more of those. You know, I love hearing that stuff. I love hearing that kind of that voice that comes through in a song of that nature. You just know you're in the hands of the experts.
Yeah.
You
and
know
that's,
that,
and that's what's so great about country music, and it's always a shame, I guess, when we have too many songs on the radio that aren't like that, because you can get, you know, pop songs on pop stations, but it's so great to hear stuff that is country and tells a story, whether it's an actual story or even just paints an emotion.
Yeah. Well, we've mentioned a couple of, you know, just in these few minutes. I mean, Whiskey Lullaby could only be a country song. Old Red is absolutely a country song. In Color, one of my favorite songs of recent years. That is so good. That's just so
well done.
It's a great
song.
And again, that could only come out of country music, I think. I just don't think there's another genre that is using words in quite that fashion, and is as concerned about getting a story told and you know, satisfying a listener in that way, in a way that doesn't necessarily just have to do with the sound. I mean, it's great to have great production and big drums and terrific guitar licks, and Nashville, of course, is famous for all of that. But boy, stick a good song in the center of all that. Stick The Gambler or something in the middle of all that, and then you've got something that's just going to last forever.
Exactly. Yeah, the production won't last. I mean, the song is what's going to last ultimately, and all you need is that voice and the guitar on a classic song like The Gambler, as you mentioned, or other examples. But let's turn to a song of yours. We're going to come back, talk about lots more about songwriting. There's a story about Gordon Lightfoot we're going to get to. Tons of other stuff. But the first song we're going to share, Larry, is, and it's got a great title to it, too, and I'll let you tell the story behind the song, but Between a Rock and a Heartache was an early 90s hit for Lee Greenwood, a great artist. I actually had him on the show about a week ago. Can you talk about the song and just a little bit behind it?
Well, I was living in Vancouver at that time, and I had started to have a fairly substantial career, relatively speaking. I was doing a lot of writing. I was doing a lot of production. I was, people were writing articles about me. I did a couple of radio interviews like this one and so forth, so I was kind of on the scene in Vancouver in the late 80s, early 90s. And one friend that I made in that community was Ron Irving, who at that time was fronting a band called Bootleg and was himself a very good songwriter, a very, very good networker. And Ron and I got to know one another and would occasionally get together and do some writing. And he called me up one day. He was... He was a little bit excited. He said, what do you think of Between a Rock and a Hard Place as a title? And I said, well, it's a very common saying, and people know what it means. I said, it'd probably make a good title. And we talked a bit more, and he had another friend of his, a guy named David Simmons, whom I've never even met to this day, who lives on Vancouver Island. Apparently, Dave, in a phone call or a letter or something, had suggested this title, and Ron got intrigued by it and started working on a tune for it. So he said, well, we should get together and work on that. I said, yeah, let's do that. And I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, I think we ended the conversation with, you know, having made a date to get together the next day or the day after. And again, if I'm remembering correctly, I think I thought a bit and called him back because I had a thought at the back of my mind, and I said, play me a bit of that melody you've been working with. And he did. And
yeah.
the way it scanned out, the way that melody scanned out, I said, we could put Between a Rock and a Heartache, and that would be, you know, more of a clever country twist,
yes,
on it.
Yes, definitely.
And he immediately liked that, and we did in fact get together a day or two later and write that song. We liked it. It had a kind of a almost a gospel sort of drop D funkiness about it that we both liked, and we went into a little studio that we knew of, and we got Jerry King, who was another member of Bootleg, a guy with a great voice. He used to get hired to do a lot of commercials and whatnot, real craggy sounding voice, and got him to sing the demo, and basically just started shopping it around. A couple of interesting things. Well, just more on how the thing got cut. Ron got an Ann Murray cut, not too much beyond the point we're talking about here in 1990 or perhaps 91. And the producer on that was Jerry Crutchfield out of Nashville, who was also, I believe, working as a Capitol vice president at that time, and was a pretty hot producer in those days. And so Ron was very happy with this song called Bluebird, which was cut by Ann Murray, and now had a relationship with Crutchfield. And Ron sent Between a Rock and a Heartache down to Crutchfield because he was working with and had been working with Lee Greenwood for some time, and he was in the process mm-hmm. of putting an album together. And he liked the song and wanted to do it, and they did in fact record it. It went pretty smoothly. One interesting thing, and you won't know this, I don't think. You know, we thought we had a pretty unique title there. Well, I've since seen that title three or four other times. You know, whether we had it first or not, I don't know. But it turned out that I believe it was Sweethearts of the Rodeo.
Okay.
At that very time, had recorded a song that they were calling Between a Rock and a Heartache. A totally different song. I did hear
it. Wow.
Totally different song. And they even had a video on it.
Wow.
And we were lucky. Our song got out first, and they changed the title of theirs. And they changed it to the second line of their chorus, which was Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea.
Oh, okay. Very interesting that something as original as that, seemingly original, I would say so, that around the same time too. But we should let our listeners know titles can't be copyrighted. But I guess it's a good idea. You don't want people to confuse your song for that purpose. You don't want to confuse people.
No, and especially when you got something that does have a bit of a twist to it. You know, that obviously is not. Had it been Between a Rock and a Hard Place. You know, there'd probably be dozens with that title, but the fact that we had twisted it a little bit and thought we were so clever, you know, I learned, I suppose, a bit of a humbling lesson, although I wasn't, I was feeling pretty good at the time because we had a song on the radio by an American artist on a major label, and it was being played every 5 minutes, it seemed, in Vancouver, and Ron and I were happy guys. So,
yeah, it was a big hit and a great song. Let's share it now, Larry, and then we'll come back. And again, we have lots more to talk about with Larry Wayne Clark. Right now, this is Lee Greenwood, a hit from the early 90s, Between a Rock and a Heartache, here on In the Country.
There's a calm before the storm in the deep blue of your eyes. So many danger signs I've come to recognize. I should go, but I hold on, I swallow back my pride. Leaving should be natural, but how can I decide? Between a rock and a heartache, there's just no place. wake up, rise to face the day. Swear this time is over, there's nothing left to say. You call me up, sweet talking, say can we be friends? Even though it's crazy, I know I'm trapped again. Between a rock and a heartache, there's just no place left to turn. Way down deep, I know I can't win. With the choice I've got to make, between a rock and a heartache. I look ahead and all I see is bad news. It tears me up to know that I've got to choose between a rock and a heartache. There's just no place left to turn. Way down deep, I know I can't win. With the choice I've got to make, between a rock and a heartache. Between a rock and a heartache, there's just no place left to turn. Way down deep, so I can't win. With the choice I've got to make, between a rock and a heartache. Between a rock and a heartache. Between a rock and a heartache.
Lee Greenwood and Between a Rock and a Heartache, a song that our guest had a hand in writing, and of course our guest Larry Wayne Clark on the line from New Brunswick. We have a lot more to cover here, including a couple more songs on the way written by Larry. Now, around that same time, you had a hit, but I guess it was an album cut by a legendary group called the Statler Brothers, who most of us will remember. The song was called To Make a Long Story Short. How did that feel to have a big group like that record one of your songs, Larry?
You know, to be deadly honest about it, let me first say that I was very pleased with the Greenwood recording. It took me a couple of listens to get the demo out of my head and get focused on what Jerry Crutchfield had done with that production. But
right.
I think that's a beautifully produced record. It is. Just listening to it again, it's just like a perfect little example of what they do in Nashville. You know, the everything is tight, everything is in the pocket. I have to admit I didn't like the Statler Brother one as well. I certainly like the idea of having a song cut by them, and you know, have certainly bragged about it from time to time. But I wasn't crazy about the recording, and that happens when you do this. You know,
I'll bet.
You write these songs, you throw them out there, and you hope they'll find a home, and you hope beyond that that they'll find a good home, and something charmed will happen with them. And I was never really charmed by the Statler Brothers thing, but you know, I'm glad it happened. I knew it wasn't going to be a single, and it just didn't quite get to me in the same way. But
something can happen. Something can happen along the way, can it? You can have that great song that you've written, and like you said, here's two different scenarios: the Statler Brothers, and whether it was the production or whatever happened. And in Lee Greenwood's case, they took that great song and did everything right with it, and that really made it a hit. So you need to have the great song, but you also need to have the right singer and great production.
Yeah, you do. You have to have your ducks in a row. However, whatever that saying really means, you have to get a bit lucky, I suppose. And
sure.
At this point now, I've had at some level. I don't mean at a serious money making level, but I've had hundreds of songs cut, and I'm always getting an MP3 in the mail or something from somebody who's cut something or maybe a couple of things, and this may just be an artist demo or an independent record that's only ever going to be heard in a locality somewhere, but you get to where you listen with a somewhat calloused ear, because most of the time, if you work hard at your demos like I do, and so many Nashville songwriters do, most of the time these recordings will not surpass the demo. But every now and again they will. Every now and again you hear some true magic, and that just, you know, lights the fire all over again, and something surpasses your expectations.
Now, for those songwriters who are listening who get demos done, sometimes they get them in Nashville or here in Canada, can you sort of explain how finished the product has to be? In some cases, I've heard a song for a ballad can be, obviously they've all got to be good recordings, but it can be just a piano or a guitar and a vocal. If it's a faster song, up-tempo song, it's got to be a full production. How good do the demos have to be, Larry?
Well, that's the ongoing question that will never ever be answered, definitively. It just because it can't. It is a situational thing. It depends on the song, and what you've just described there is, I believe that to be true in most cases, that a ballad can very often just be sustained with one instrument and a good singer. Whereas if you're trying to, if you think you've written the next Jason Aldean hit, and you really want it to rock, and you want people to hear screaming guitars and loud drums and a lap steel and a B3 organ and harmonies and all this stuff. I mean, people in Nashville, are thinking nothing. Well, maybe they're thinking about it, but they're still constantly going in and doing demos that may cost up to $1,000, and those demos will sound as good as any record you hear on the radio. I mean, they will. They're very often using the same musicians' studios, using great hired singers for the most part, and these people will make very, very expensive demos, and publishing companies are constantly complaining that they're going bankrupt staying up with their, staying on top of their demo budget. And sometimes it's another writer. If the song is written by two or three people, sometimes it's the other publisher who is the excited one who gets, puts a demo session together and includes this or that song that you happen to be a part of. And so you sort of get sucked into that whole process.
Right.
Maybe you or maybe your publisher, if you have one, wasn't particularly sold on spending money on that song, but here you are doing it. And you can spend a lot of money on demos, so I do caution people to be careful in picking the songs that they demo and making sure that they're finished. Taking a fully demoed song to be critiqued somewhere and getting perhaps some very good advice on it that requires making a change is heartbreaking, because that means you have to, probably rehire a singer, perhaps,
yeah,
and go back in the studio and remix the thing. Not as hard now as it used to, because everything's on computers, but, if you're going to invest heavily in a song, and, for most songwriters, a demo that I never spent $1,000, but, several hundred dollars, $500-$600 is not unusual, and most songwriters are not rolling in money, and they just can't afford to be investing at that level. So you have to be careful what you spend the big money on, and develop a means of doing demos more modestly that will serve certain songs, but will still serve them well. You can't
right. Just
even though you maybe are only having a voice and piano or a voice and guitar featured, they have to sound good. They have to. It should sound like it came out of a studio, even if the studio is in your spare room.
Exactly.
It should sound like it.
Good.
Oh yeah,
yep.
And people are making great demos in their spare rooms now. But I'll tell you, at the other end of the spectrum, songwriters are constantly coming up with what we, for some reason, persist in calling work tapes, although nobody records on tape anymore. But, you know, a
right.
couple of songwriters get together and they write a song at the kitchen table or on the back porch or wherever, and when they're done with the song and they're all proud of it and it's shiny and new, they get their guitars tuned up and they play it into a tape recorder or some kind of a digital device. And
sure.
that becomes your work tape, and that's your record of that song, so you don't forget it. And again, if you have a publisher, that's what you'll show your publisher. That, you know, it's what we wrote this week, and I'm kind of liking it, and see what you think. And that's a work tape. It's got no reverb. It's got no effects. It's probably going to have a couple of mistakes. You may hear a siren going by. You may hear a dog barking. But often, curious thing, often those things have a wonderful spark about them because the dough is still sticky on your fingers. I don't
yes.
know. They're still warm. You know, they're still warm
yeah.
out of the oven. And there is something magical about that. And in certain cases, people will pitch work tapes. Now certainly we do. Myself and my partner Maggie have a publishing company, and we pitch a lot of work tapes. Now I'm talking in some cases about work tapes sung by Chris Young and Buddy Jewell, and right. But sometimes sung by a person who's virtually a non-singer, which is where I kind of see myself, and. You know, you just have these songs that for some reason you can see, if you know what to look for, you can see some magic in them. Now, you probably aren't going to send a work tape to an artist. That isn't very often, particularly a young artist, because they're used to hearing all these $1,000, $1,200 demos, and that's
exactly.
what they think of. That's what they think a song, you know, that's the way they think a song needs to be demonstrated. Because that's what everybody else is doing, but a producer, particularly if that producer has a background in songwriting, which many do, producers very often love work tapes, and I've even heard of situations where a producer has received a very high quality demo and said, "I'm liking that song. Do you have a work tape of it? In other words, do you have something stripped down?" Where I can just hear the bare bones of it and let my imagination fill in the gaps.
That's a good point because
so,
the producer, of course, wants to put in all those extra things, and if they're already there, there's not as much imagination and not as many places he can go in his mind when he's got the raw form of the song, he can start to add on to it.
Yeah, there's true magic to work tapes, and of course, Nashville is famous for its writers' nights at the Bluebird and other places where you listen to a group of songwriters play their songs with just a guitar or a piano, and whether or not they happen to be great singers, some of them are, some of them are terrible singers, but what counts is the song. That's the product on display, and a work tape is kind of a recorded equivalent of a performance that you would catch at a writer's night, I think. And sometimes
Is there an artist out there who has eluded you so far in terms of a pitch? There's an artist out there that you're really wanting to have record one of your songs, and you feel maybe you're getting close, but not quite.
Oh boy,
probably a list, I'm sure.
The list would be long and depressing. at the end of it, people that I'm really liking right now. I was very proud of the Chris Young cut because I think he is somebody who's going to shape into a really special artist. I think he's very good. I just love what he does with his voice. Some of the guys that I've admired over the years are either in their, you know, deep into their seniority now or have, in fact, gone and died on me in the last decade or so, which is
yeah.
which is bad. You know, we've lost some of the classic singers. But you know, in terms of who I would really really love to hear do something, Dolly Parton would be a thrill because she's just so magical. She's so she's been doing this so well for so long and is so truly talented. I mean,
yes,
such a good songwriter herself that when she adopts a song from another writer, that's a pretty special thing. Of course, I'd love to have a George Strait cut. He's made so many classic records and continues to
keeps on going.
Crank out, yeah, some really really good sounding stuff. I'd love to have something by him. Back when he was still alive, I would have loved to have had a Vern Gosden recording because that was just a voice in a million. We lost him a while ago. You know, and others of the young guys, I think Josh Turner is a terrific singer. I think Joe Nichols is the real thing. And I've met him. I actually wrote with him years ago, and this is a guy that can sit there with a guitar, and he can play you every song Merle Haggard ever sang. he is a true fan of country music, and Miranda Lambert is emerging into something very special. I think she's just going to keep getting better. I'd love to have a Reba cut. I've had a bunch of holds with her, and just never gotten through the gate with her. But I would love to have one. And you know, other genres too.
Yeah, I was going to say that, other genres. That was actually my next question. Is there somebody from outside of country music that you dream about having a song recorded?
Yeah, I like writing jazzy things. It's another genre that I admire a great deal. I've always been a big admirer of the Sinatra and Nelson Riddle recordings from the 50s and 60s, and I like that music a lot. I like songs from the 30s and 40s, and they have such beautiful chords and melodies and such an elegance about them. And so, I'd love to get something cut by anybody who represents that genre, like Michael Bublé, Diana Krall, to name Harry Connick Jr. I mean, I think those people are all extremely valid artists, and I'd love to get something by them.
Well, you do a great job.
I mean, I
could
go on all day. Who I want to cut my?
Yeah, exactly. That could be a whole show. But you, on the subject of jazz music, on the CD, and we'll talk a bit about this, Larry. LWC, Larry Wayne Clark, Favorite Songs of Larry Wayne Clark, is a CD with 20 songs on it. But the song, the jazz song, it sounds very jazzy to me, is Nothing Says Goodbye Like a Train. And on this CD, a lot of the other songs are other vocalists, but you actually do the vocals on this song. It sounds great, and it's got that jazz feel, too. I guess, is it an out-and-out jazz song?
Well, I would say it is. I do tend to perform that when I do a writer's night, and I had one fellow in Nashville one time say, you know, you should pitch that song to Tim McGraw. I bet you he would hear that. But and maybe he would, because Tim McGraw will step outside of the box. But, you know, for the most part,
right,
that is a flat-out jazz song in the style of Cry Me a River or Angel Eyes or one of those minor key type jazz things. I just adore those things. And I'm very proud of that song. I like that song a lot.
It's a great song. Yeah, I really enjoyed listening to it. And there's a video, I believe, at your website, LarryWayneClark.com, and YouTube, where you can see you talking a bit about it and performing. But let's talk about this CD, 20 songs put together, and I believe this is a fundraiser. Do you want to sort of talk about the making of this CD?
Well, I guess the real beginnings of it, rather unfortunately, is that I discovered earlier this year, I guess it was back in February, not long after I turned 60, I discovered that I had cancer. I went in and had some tests done and discovered that I had cancer, which you know, on many levels, was very bad news. For one thing, you never want to hear you have cancer, but for another, here I was spending the bulk of my time in Nashville. You know, I did sort of have an Ontario connection also, but spending most of my time in Nashville, and I didn't have any kind of American health insurance. Of course, being a Canadian, I was insured up here. So it became very, very obvious very quickly that we would be returning to Canada. And eventually that led me to New Brunswick, where I have a lot of family and a lot of a good support system here. That was a very chaotic time and somewhat alarming time. And we headed back up to Ontario to have more tests done, and then went about the business of putting a property up for rent and moving away from the States. And a friend of ours, you know, we made some great friends down there over a period of 15 years or so, and one friend had the idea of putting together a fundraiser, which musicians are, you know, do all the time. I mean, it's a very common thing, especially in the States where so many musicians are uninsured. So anyway, this friend of ours put a little team together, a few other of our friends, and they decided to put together this fundraiser, which would be partially an auction and a show. There would be people one after another getting up and doing songs, and it was a great evening. As it turned out, it was a great evening. And somebody in the midst of all this planning, which we were sort of peripherally aware of, we were being kept in the loop, but we weren't actually part of the planning. But somebody said, you know, Larry, you should put together a CD of all these songs you've got, or some of these songs you've got, and we'll auction it, we'll sell it at the fundraiser, and maybe you can sell it elsewhere. Which was interesting because, you know, one thing I have never, ever considered myself as any kind of a recording artist, but this was not really featuring me as a recording artist. This was featuring me as a generator and collector of songs and yes, interesting stories to go with them.
Yes. Yeah, I like how the booklet within the CD has the stories behind the songs, how they sort of came about, which adds a lot to the enjoyment.
Yeah, that was fun to do. That was fun to do. It was hard to pick 20, but it was a great deal of fun to do that. And, you know, I was really happy to pay tribute to these people. Very often I'm writing with singers, so quite often the singer heard on the CD on a given song will be the co-writer, and
right,
some of them are just fabulous. Some of them are just fabulous.
There's awesome songs on here, including I Want to Live Like That, which now I understand, Larry, that has gotten a tremendous response and some good recordings of it.
Oh, my God, it gets recorded. It sometimes seems every month somebody does something with that song. And I wrote that with a dear friend of mine from Vancouver, Kathy Ann, who's now Kathy Ann McClintock. Had a different name in those days, and she was part of a little kind of a bluegrass, kind of a new acoustic bluegrass band with a banjo and a fiddle, and her sister playing upright bass, and Kathy Ann singing, and they were called Tumbleweed, and they're very popular in Vancouver for a while, and Kathy Ann went on to meet Stephen McClintock, who's an American singer, songwriter, producer, entrepreneur,
yep,
very, and they got married. They're now living in L.A., but for a time they were living in a house in Nashville, and they had a baby, and Kathy Ann came over to the house one day with this, this little child who's now, I believe, in her young teens. I think I'm about 13, and can she be that old? I'm thinking, as I say that, is that even possible?
Time flies.
She may only be 12, but anyway, she was a little tiny girl in a plastic portable playpen sitting on my kitchen floor while I was writing this song with her mother, who had written down all the, you know, the song is kind of a list of things. You know, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to do this, I want to do that. And she had a lot of that already made up, and she had, you know, a little tape recorder with her. And Kathy is not much of a player, not much of a instrumentalist, but she had sung a bunch of these lines into this tape recorder. And right away, you could see the magic of it. I mean, it was it was lovely. Stephen is forever jealous that she didn't go to him with that song. But anyway,
that's it. Yep. There's some great songs out here, and I want to go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, I was just going to say we completed it, and it was a favorite right from the beginning, and somehow has he avoided having a major cut, but it will in some genre.
Yeah, so great songs like that will keep going around, and it's great to hear that there's been that kind of response and so many different cuts on it. And there's, as I said, 20 great songs in here that you've had a hand in writing, and you're doing vocals on Nothing Says Goodbye Like a Train, so we get to hear some of your singing. Lisa Brokop's on here along with a bunch of other vocalists, some we know, some we may not, but they're all great. But I want to turn, well, first of all, before we turn back to the music on the show here, can you let listeners know how they can go about getting the CD, Larry?
Go to my website. I'm terrible at this stuff. I should have all this memorized, and I'm terrible at this stuff. But it's easy to find me, Larry Wayne Clark. I mean, just Google my name, or LarryWayneClark.com, I guess, is my website. And it is being sold from there. There's a link from there. That's as easy a way as any to get it, and also to perhaps listen to some other songs. I have other clips up there, and so I would, if people are interested, I would encourage them to visit my website. That's what it's there for.
Yep, more details there, and of course more audio clips. You can hear the songs, get an idea of them. It's a great CD, Songs of Larry Wayne Clark. Well, speaking of Songs of Larry Wayne Clark, a big hit now for Chris Young that our listeners will recognize, and there's a great story behind it and sort of how you met up with Chris. Many will remember him from Nashville Star, and he's since gone on in the last couple of years to have some pretty big hits at radio.
Yep.
His latest is called Voices. But this song is Drinking Me Lonely. A great country song. Can you talk all about this one, Larry?
Yeah. Again, I don't know how much time we have here, but I had become a fan of Nashville Star from the beginning because Buddy Jewell was a friend of mine, and I was co-writing with him quite a lot. And of course, he won that first season. And I used to go to the tapings more often than not. It wasn't too far from where I was staying in Nashville. Another thing that I did was also checking out a chat group, I guess, to do with Nashville Star. I would check in there and occasionally post. And this guy, Chris, was on there posting all the time, and his mother was on there. And obviously, a lot of the people on that group knew of Chris and were always saying, you know, Chris, you're such a great singer yourself. You need to be on that show. And And Chris was a big fan of Buddy Jewell. That was obvious. So anyway, I became interested, and I checked out Chris Young. I Googled him or found a MySpace or something, and found this kid who was probably about 17 at that time, very tall, and had this lovely sort of deep molasses voice that just didn't belong to a teenager, and had already done a simple independent recording at that time, was obviously really motivated to be a country singer. And so I contacted him. I sent him a message and said, you know, I'm a friend of Buddy Jewell's and co-writer in two or three things I've heard you mention, and I'd like to get to know you better. Maybe we can write a song. So and I included my phone number, and he did in fact call and came to visit one day on a weekend. He was still in school, and we just started writing there. We wrote probably I'm sometimes surprised when I count them all up, but you know, maybe as many as 20 songs. And
nice.
And right from the beginning, they were pretty good, and I was impressed by the fact that he wanted to write real country songs. He was a big fan of Merle Haggard and especially Marty Robbins, big Marty Robbins fan. Is where that falsetto thing comes from, and and so we would write these songs, and it was funny. Very often they were honky tonk songs or drinking songs. And here's this kid who's not old enough to drink, and we keep on writing these songs, but he just liked writing that style of thing, and meanwhile he was going from strength to strength. He was putting bands together and doing shows around town. Then he got a job in a honky tonk for a while in Texas. He actually quit that to go on to Nashville Star. He was living in Texas for a few months playing at Cowboys, and. So, he was good, and he came to me one day with the beginnings of Drinking Me Lonely and the first few lines of it and the title. He wanted to write that, and we did. And it just, somewhere along the way, it just took a couple little curves that made it really special. You know, there's that falsetto thing, of course, which just kept getting better and better the more he did it. But that's a selling point in that song. That's almost a little yodel on the lonely. And just the there was a nice darkness to it. That was just it was an awful lot of fun to write it. And I loved hearing him sing it. You know, I heard him sing it quite a few times before Nashville Star came up. You know, in various little shows he'd do around town and. And he was getting great response to that song. Everybody was saying, that song is going to do something for you. So, lo and behold, he got on the Nashville Star, and from the beginning did really well. But it seems that from the moment he sang that song on the Originals week, there was a whole new buzz around him. And
it is a great song, and our listeners will, of course, be reminded of it now if they haven't heard it in a bit. It's Chris Young. He co-wrote the song along with my guest Larry Wayne Clark, and it is Drinking Me Lonely here on In the Country.
I'm pushing you away each time I pull up that old barstool, drowning you in every drop I drink, telling you to go to hell, but I'm talking to myself, 'cause you're not around to hear what I think. I'm trying to teach my heart to hate you, but it ain't working right. Now the truth is I'm only drinking me lonely tonight. And Lord, it's more than just thirsty that I'm feeling inside, 'cause these tears I've been crying have left me bone dry. I wish the bartender had a cure I could buy, but the truth is I'm only drinking me lonely tonight. You said I'd have to choose between your love and this old barroom. I just laughed, but I guess you knew best. Who cares who's right or wrong tonight? My better half is gone. Whiskey's laying claim to all that's left. So I'll just order up another and pretend I'm alright, when the truth is I'm only drinking me lonely tonight. And Lord, it's more than just thirsty that I'm feeling. Bartender had a cure I could buy, truth is I'm only drinking me lonely tonight. So I'll just order up another and pretend I'm alright, when the truth is I'm only drinking me lonely tonight.
A beautiful song sung by Chris Young and written by Chris and my guest, Larry Wayne Clark. That is Drinking Me Lonely. Great, great song. You must be so proud of that one, Larry.
I am. I thank you for your kind words. And yes, I am proud of that song. It's hard to find a song and hard to write a song that has a surprise in it. And that one does. That little... You know, again, that falsetto part, the chords that happen there, what happens with the melody there, and, of course, the way he sings it so beautifully, that song still surprises me a little. And, you know, I can only say that Chris is one of the great singers out there right now, because he can do that. He can do that sitting 2 feet away from you. That's not studio magic or anything. He can sing
that's
that.
That's all him.
In your face, and I still have the work tape. Talking about work tapes, I still have the work tape of that one that we laid down in my my dining room in Nashville. And you know, it's largely what you hear. It doesn't have the little guitar lick that was at the beginning that got added later, but it is largely what you're hearing there.
Now, for our listeners who are artists themselves who want to, work towards a CD and are thinking about that and are looking for great songs, you've got a whole catalog, of course. How do they get in touch with you to begin that process to listen to some of your stuff and see if it's right for their project?
Again, just go to our website. People make inquiries of MySpace and Facebook and everything else, but the website is a good place to go. You can actually hear some song samples and make contact there, and we get back to everybody. I mean, you know, no act too small. We deal with everybody. Anybody that flatters us by wanting to hear our songs, we'll make sure they do. And we get inquiries like that all the time, and the website has been a blessing, really, you know, given the fact that we had to leave Nashville and come up to Eastern Canada. In many ways, we've barely lost momentum in the eyes of the world. People
exactly.
Don't know where you are or people
yep.
Send you an email.
But that website keeps the presence going, and people can still touch base and see what you're up to. And yeah, there's some great stuff at the website too. You sort of talk about your roles as a songwriter and producer and then the whole history of how you got interested in the whole music business. So I'd encourage people to go to LarryWayneClark.com, if for only that reason, to learn a bit more about you.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. This is what I do. I suddenly find myself looking back 60 years old, realizing that I've been doing this for a long time. And, you know, I've seen Lisa Brokaw go from being a 12-year-old that used to go to outdoor festivals so she could get up with the band and sing. And, now she's a grown woman with her own baby, and we still know her, you know. There's just so many stories that have passed through our lives and intertwined with our lives doing this.
Now some of the artists you've been writing with over the last few years, some great Canadian talent, and there is so much great Canadian country talent, artists like Derek James Tilley, who wanted me to pass on a hello to you, Ivan Daigle, who I had on the show recently and was raving about writing with you, and there's Colin Amy, Adam Gregory, who you've written a song for,
oh,
After Tuesday, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, the list goes on. Yeah, do you want to sort of talk about some of the Colin Amy in there? I may have mentioned just all these great Canadian artists you've been working with.
Well, you've named a good list on there. Another one, Andrea Pearson, who was just a young kid when I met her in British Columbia, now living in Nashville. She has a publishing deal. Fabulous singer and a very, very imaginative writer. She's on the CD with a song, If I Can't Have Tomorrow, is her singing. And she's a terrific singer.
Right.
That, you know, but Canada should be proud to claim. And I don't know, doesn't have a record deal. I don't know if she's going for that anymore, but definitely somebody that I could listen to all day. She's a great singer. Colin is great. I like what he does. Adam is a real favorite of mine, Adam Gregory. I didn't know him back in his, you know, teenage incarnation as a Canadian heartthrob in his teens, but met him in Nashville, where he's now living. At that time, he was kind of commuting, but I believe he lives there now. And, I've just gotten to know him, and he is a sterling young man. You know, you just can't find anything bad to say about Adam. He's a very sweet-natured human being and a terrific talent. Terrific talent. I love to hear him sing and
he's got
play
a great voice,
guitar.
Sure.
And we've written a bunch of things that I like a lot. One of them ended up on an album that he did a few years back, but I think that whole label has disappeared now, and I don't know where that was left. It seems like it left him with a bad taste in his mouth, which is too bad because I love this song, and we continue to pitch kind of a gospel song. And some of the others up in your area, Misty Olson, terrific
yes.
singer and songwriter.
Yep.
Worked with her a little bit.
Francelle Maria, we can't forget her either. Francelle was a guest on the show.
Francelle Maria, yes.
Yes.
Well, interesting that I met her in, she was brought down to Nashville with J.R. Vautour. They're going to produce an album on her, and she had some free time before the recording started, and she wanted to do some writing, so J.R. hooked her up with me, and we wrote two songs, and she ended up cutting both of them, which was, it should always be that easy.
exactly.
Really, I mean,
that's
the way
you want it to work. Two for two ratio.
Yeah, and JR did a great job on them. She did a great job, and I didn't know her. She was from out here in New Brunswick, but at the time I was still down in Nashville, and so I knew very little about her. And now, as fate would have it, here I am in New Brunswick, living probably an hour and a half away from her. In fact, she came down here not long ago one day to do some writing. She was going on a French television show, and she wanted to write a French song. I don't speak French, but she had some ideas, and she wanted me to help out with the tune and the chords and all the rest of it. So we ended up writing a French song and writing another song that same day. We spent the whole day together, and lo and behold, a few weeks later, we put on the TV, and there she was doing this French song.
That's a terrific story. There's another artist out there, too. I'm not sure. I don't think you've worked with this artist, but she's followed your career and loves your songwriting. Kristen T. Clark, who is from the Peterborough area, and she's a great singer, songwriter, and guitarist.
Yeah, I met Kristen with her family down in Nashville, I think during Fanfare one year. I haven't worked with her. We've never... there's just never been the opportunity. Anytime I've met her, it's been in a public place. And,
she mentioned she'd be listening. Yeah.
Yeah, we trade emails and that kind of thing, but we've never gotten around to working. But very talented young woman, and I wish her all the best, and greetings to her if she is, in fact, listening.
Yeah, she was going to be listening because she mentioned how much she enjoys your work and your music. Let's turn it around. There you go. Exactly. Clark is a great last name. We're going to turn back to the music and staying on the subject of Canadian country. J.D. Bixby, of course, we all know him from Canadian Idol and then his subsequent country hits. He's made a big impact. And I interviewed him a while back as well. The song is Dream Bigger, which I understand is going to be his next radio single in January. And I'll let you take the story from there.
Well, fingers crossed on that. That's what we're told. And it will be the next single. And I hope so, because J.D. is one of the Canadian independents who's getting a lot of airplay, and the radio seems to have embraced him, and of course that's what we want, is that radio airplay.
Definitely.
I wrote the song. JD is a writer on it. He came into it a bit later, but initially started with a guy named Doug Sylvester, I don't know how I met Doug. He, Canadian coming to Nashville, that got my number from somebody and called me up and wanted to write, and we've since gotten together and written a few really quite good songs, including this one. But it was just one of those things that happen when you do this for a while. People set you up with other writers, people will give your phone number to somebody if they think they're, worthy of having it. They, you got to be careful with that kind of stuff. But Doug Sylvester was clearly, when I spoke to him, clearly a driven guy who loved writing songs and hadn't, nothing had happened for him yet, but he was... he was just working hard, going down to Nashville, working with people, and he's from Saskatoon, if I'm not mistaken. So we wrote this song, and we demoed it down in Nashville, liked it a lot, and then he got it to JD's people, and JD liked it, but he wanted to make some changes in it to suit him, his age, and so forth. So he did a bit of rewriting on it, and so he's now included in the writing of the song, and everybody on his team seemed to like it. They cut a good record with Bill Buckingham in Vancouver, and I think he sounds good. I've never met the young man. I'd love to sit down and write with him in person sometime, but I think he's got quite a busy road schedule. But he sounds good. I love what they've done with the record. I think it'll sound great on the radio. Probably better than it's going to sound on my telephone in a minute here. But
exactly.
It's interesting hearing these songs over the phone. But that's about the story of that. It's not a great big long story, but let's hope it.
Let's hear it. Yeah, share this, a sneak preview of sorts for many, many, many people will not have heard this yet, but it's going to be released to radio in January. It's J.D. Bixby, and it's called Dream Bigger here on In the Country.
Get me gone from here. Hey,
you gotta dream bigger.
J.D. Bixby here on In the Country. The song is called Dream Bigger, and that is going to be his radio release come this January. So be sure to call your local country stations to request it when that time comes around. Great song and great hook there. When you're from a small town, you got to dream bigger. Love it. Love it. Great song.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah,
a lot of people told me that. You know, a lot of you need a lot of people that come from small towns, and they're just that little bit more ambitious because they're trying to... They want to be competitive. They don't want to be considered small time, so they try a little bit harder. And,
exactly. Well, it's a great song, and all three songs we shared, the Lee Greenwood song, Between a Rock and a Heartache, Chris Young, Drinking Me Lonely, and the new one there from J.D. Bixby, Dream Bigger. Great songs to share all with Larry Wayne Clark's songwriting. There's also a CD for our listeners. They can go to LarryWayneClark.com for a CD called Songs of Larry Wayne Clark. 20 songs on there with various vocalists, and the 20th song on there, Nothing Says Goodbye Like a Train, is sung by Larry himself. It's been such a pleasure having you on for this time. I think the show's been a little over an hour. We've covered a lot of ground, and so thank you so much, Larry, for being on the show and sharing
those
stories.
Thank you for your interest, and thank you for what you're doing. I think what you're performing a valuable service for Canadian country music, and I appreciate that, and I'm sure many do. So I salute you for doing it.
Thank you so much. Yeah, my pleasure to do the show. Love country music and love talking to songwriters like yourself to hear the stories behind all these songs. It's always great to hear them.
Well, thank you, Dave. I've really enjoyed this.
It's been great, and of course, we'll encourage our listeners to check out, once again, LarryWayneClark.com. And if you have a comment on today's show, send me an email at inthecountry@mail.com. That, once again, is inthecountry@mail.com. We'd love to hear your feedback on the show today. I'm Dave Woods, and that'll wrap up this edition of In the Country.
Spend some time in the country. We're glad that you dropped by. Town in the country, leave your worries behind. There's lots of fun for everyone, the best in music too. Spend some time in the country, we've been waiting here